Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Alison Van Diggelen. I'm host of Fresh Dialogues and I'm a contributor to the BBC. It's my pleasure to introduce Professor Matt Walker, author of Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. Matt is a professor of neuroscience and psychology and director of the Sleep and Neuroimaging Laboratory at the University of California, Berkeley. He previously worked as a sleep researcher and professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and founded the Center for Human Sleep Science. Professor Walker has published more than 100 scientific studies and served as scientific counsel for several tech companies, including Google and Fitbit. For his pioneering work in neuroscience and psychiatry, Professor Walker has been recognized by the National Institutes of Health and the National Academy of Sciences. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Professor Matt Walker.
By the way, it's a complete ruse that I have to go back to a sleep clinic. It's simply to get everyone in bed early. If we end the event earlier, I think we'll all sleep earlier. So that's. But thank you for accommodating that.
So tonight we're planning to have it all Q&A. There's so much we want to discuss, and I'm expecting a lot of questions from the audience. To give it some structure tonight, what I want to do is frame the question or frame the problem. So, Matt, you have described sleep, this issue of sleep, as the greatest public health challenge we face in the 21st century. And you say we must reclaim our right to a full night's of sleep without embarrassment or the damaging stigma of laziness. Can you expand on what you mean by that?
I can. Firstly, what we know is that we are sleeping significantly less than we did a century ago. So there was a wonderful survey done by Gallup back in 1942. The average American adult was sleeping 7.9 hours. Now we know from a survey by the National Sleep Foundation that the average American adult is sleeping just 6 hours and 31 minutes. In the UK, that's 6 hours and 49 minutes. In Japan, 6 hours and 22 minutes. So there has been a decimation of sleep throughout industrialized nations. You know, it took Mother Nature 3.6 million years to put this thing called 8 hours of sleep for human beings in place. And then we come along and lop off maybe 20, 25% of that within the space of just 70 or 80 years. How could it not have a demonstrable impact on our health and our wellness? And the evidence for that statement is very clear, too. First, you can take a big picture view from epidemiological studies, and a simple truth becomes clear. The shorter your sleep, the shorter your life. Short sleep predicts all-cause mortality. We can then take it a step down and ask, well, what is it that's killing us when we are underslept? Every major disease that is related to death throughout the developed world has links, associations, and many of them causal to a lack of sleep. That list includes cancer, Alzheimer's disease, diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, not to mention recently suicide as well. So what we clearly understand is that that insufficient sleep, that elastic band of sleep deprivation, can stretch only so far before it snaps. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now.
Right. And can you cite, just to wake the audience up completely, can you cite the details of that study, for example, on dementia, Alzheimer's? That's something that you're studying right now at Berkeley.
It is. So there have been some great population studies that have simply asked people, on the basis of your lifetime, how much sleep did you get on average during the week, let's say 6 hours, 7 hours, 8 hours. So they would bucket you into these sort of hour bins. And then in later life, they would scan people's brains and measure the amount of the toxic sticky protein related to Alzheimer's called beta amyloid. And then you would look to see, is there any difference in the severity of that Alzheimer's brain pathology on the basis of retrospectively how much people have been sleeping across their lifespan? And you see a very strong relationship. If I were to show you the images between those who report getting 6 hours of sleep or less versus 7 hours of sleep or more, you would need to know nothing about statistics, nothing about brain science. It would be very clear to you how different those two sets of brains on average would be. We also know, however, because that's simply associational, that it's a causal relationship. There was a remarkable discovery several years ago made about the brain and specifically sleep that relates to Alzheimer's. Your body has a sewage system that you all know of, and it's called the lymphatic system. And it was only recently that we discovered the brain also has its own sewage system. It's called the glymphatic system, named after the cells that create it, called glial cells. Now, what's interesting is that that sewage system isn't always switched on at high flow volume all of the time across the 24-hour clock face. It kicks into high gear during sleep, and particularly deep sleep. One of the toxic metabolic byproducts that that sewage system washes away at night is beta amyloid, that same toxic protein related to Alzheimer's disease. And if you deprive mice of sleep, you get a marked and immediate increase in the amount of that Alzheimer's-related protein. So it's essentially good night sleep clean in that way. Now, it turns out there is finally a vicious sting in the tail of insufficient sleep in Alzheimer's. That toxic protein does not build up all over the brain in a homogeneous manner. Some parts of the brain are attacked by that Alzheimer's protein more severely and early on during the course of the disease than other areas. Sadly, the areas that that toxic protein targets are the deep sleep-generating regions. So now we have this vicious cycle. If you're not sleeping enough, more of that Alzheimer's protein builds up. Where does it build up? In the very sleep-generating regions that your brain desperately needs. So even when you decide to try and get sleep, you can't generate enough to wash away the protein. So you start getting even less sleep. So goes this vicious downward spiral. And that's why now I think the evidence starts to become clear. Insufficient sleep appears to be one of the most significant lifestyle factors determining whether or not you will develop Alzheimer's.
Scary statistic.
It is.
And talk about the link between sleep and obesity. Break that down for us. How does that work?
Insufficient sleep leads you to overeat both at the level of your brain and at the level of your body. Now, I don't mean that you're trying to push food through your body. The food goes through the mouth, but it plays out within the brain and the body. Firstly, we know from some wonderful studies that when you are getting short sleep across the week, firstly, the hormone that signals to your brain, you're full, you've had enough food, time to stop eating, that hormone, which is called leptin, is actually impaired and blunted by a lack of sleep. So you have a meal and you don't feel satisfied by that food, so you want to eat more. If that weren't bad enough, the opposite hormone, which is called ghrelin, which actually tells your brain you're hungry, it's time to eat more, that hormone is actually ramped up and amplified by a lack of sleep. So you get sort of this bidirectional impact at the hormonal level of appetite control. So you excessively eat more. Now, you could say, well, if I'm not sleeping as much, it must mean I'm awake longer. So maybe I'm just topping up the extra energy that I'm burning. Not true. Firstly, sleep is a remarkably metabolic state. And you only burn about an extra 140 calories across an 8-hour period by lying on a couch staying awake versus losing consciousness and going to sleep. So sleep isn't the caloric energy-saving state that we once thought it was. Second, even if it were true that you burn more calories while you're awake, which is partially true, how much you excessively eat far exceeds anything that you simply additionally burn by staying awake a little longer. Next, it's not just that you eat more. What you start to eat is also problematic. You stay away from healthy leafy greens or protein, meat, etc. What you start eating when you are underslept are simple sugars and heavy-hitting carbohydrates. So even the profile of what you ingest, let alone the total caloric content, is problematic. Why would you start to choose the wrong foods? It turns out we did a study with participants with MRI scanning. We took a group of healthy adults who weren't obese, and we deprived them of sleep for a night, or we allowed them a full night of sleep. And after each of those, we placed them inside an MRI scanner. And we actually showed them some desirable food items. In fact, we showed them a whole range of different food items, from ice cream, pizza, all the way up to sort of salads, nuts. And what you see in the brain when you are underslept is that the deep hedonic reward centers within the brain light up when you are sleep deprived in response to desirable food items like a pizza or a big scoop of ice cream. And what's also interesting is that the rational regulatory control regions of the brain that sit above your eyes, regions that we call the frontal cortex or the frontal lobe, that gets shut down by sleep deprivation. So you sort of give way to this sort of hedonic impulse, and you just start reaching for that junk food. So that's how we understand that this relationship at the scientific granular level between insufficient sleep and excessive intake and this obesogenic profile. But then if you look back and you compare the curve of obesity escalation over the past 70 years, these are epidemiological studies now, you get this marked escalation, this upswing over the past 30 years. If you plot that against the amount of total sleep time that is dramatically reduced, you basically get an X shape on that graph where those two lines are going in opposite directions. As sleep time has reduced, obesity has escalated. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that the reason that we're all obese is simply because we are not sleeping. Obesity is related to poor food choices, larger food amounts and servings. It's due to a lack of physical activity. But what we also know is that those factors alone cannot by themselves explain this explosion of obesity. Something else is at play, or other things. Sleep is one of those things.
Right. So it sounds like from what you're saying, sleep is making us sick, it's making us fat, and you also make the argument that it's making us dumb. Talk about, you have to read the book. Talk about the studies that show the correlation between lack of sleep and performance in academic or memory games.
Sleep is critical for learning and memory, and it's critical in at least one of two ways. First, we know that you need sleep after learning to essentially hit the save button on those new memories so that you don't forget. In other words, sleep will future-proof the facts within your brain. And if you don't sleep, you lose out on that cementing effect, because sleep actually strengthens the synaptic connections within the brain, within that new memory circuit. And that's what prevents you from forgetting. Without sleep, that circuit of memory, of information within the brain, is more likely to dissolve, leading to forgetting rather than remembering. So sleep after learning is essential. But recently, we did a study where we discovered it's not just sleep after learning. You also need sleep before learning. But now, to actually prepare your brain, almost like a dry sponge, ready to initially soak up new information. So again, we took a group of healthy, smart undergraduates and deprived them of sleep or gave them a full 8 hours of shut eye. Next day, inside the MRI scanner again, but now they had to learn a whole list of new facts. First, when you compare those two groups head to head, a sort of Coke Pepsi challenge to see which one learned more, you find that those who got 8 hours of sleep learned almost 40% more. Wow. In terms of fact-based memorization relative to those who were sleep-deprived. To put that in context, by the way, it's simply the difference between acing an exam and failing it miserably. We also discovered why. There is a structure in the brain on the left and the right side called the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is like the informational inbox of your brain. It's sort of very good at receiving new memory files and holding on to them. And when we looked at that structure in those people who'd had a full night of sleep before learning, there was lots of healthy learning-related activity. Yet in those people who were sleep-deprived, we actually couldn't find any significant signal whatsoever. So it's almost as though sleep deprivation had shut down your memory inbox, and any new incoming files, they were just being bounced. You couldn't effectively commit new experiences to memory. Why is this relevant, by the way? I think it's relevant within the context that we face of education again. When we've looked at school start times, you can see throughout the United States, some schools will start at 7:25 in the morning. Now, for a 7:25 start, school buses will begin leaving at 5:30 in the morning. That means that some kids are having to wake up at 5:15, 5 o'clock, maybe even earlier. This is lunacy. Now, some states and counties have decided to push their school start times and examine the academic outcome consequences. And the results from those now carefully controlled studies are, I think, unequivocal. What we see is that academic grades increase, but we also see that behavioral problems decrease, truancy rates decrease, and psychological and psychiatric issues decrease.
So what would the optimum start time, if you were in charge of the school system in the world or in the United States, what is the optimum time for youth today?
10 o'clock in the morning would be the bare minimum.
Wow.
And the reason...
Good luck with that.
Well, I think, you know, we say sort of good luck, but if we choose to neglect the biology and the data, if you fight against biology, usually you lose.
Good point.
And I think if our goal, and I should also note, by the way, that in those studies where they've delayed the school start times, something else happened that we did not anticipate. The life expectancy of students increased. And you're thinking, well, I don't understand. How does that work? One of the leading causes of death in adolescent teens is car crashes. And here, sleep matters enormously. What they found in, I'll give you one example, in Teton County in Wyoming, they shifted their school start times from 7:35 in the morning to 8:55 in the morning. Still too early, but that's okay. Those students got 1 hour of extra sleep, but what they saw was a 70% reduction in car crashes that following year.
That's
to put
incredible.
That in context, the advent of ABS technology in cars, anti-lock braking systems that prevent your wheels from locking up under hard braking, that dropped accident rates by 20 to 25%, and it was deemed a revolution. Here is a simple biological factor, sleep, that will drop accident rates by up to 70%. So if our goal as educators truly is to educate and not risk lives in the process, then we are failing our children in a quite spectacular manner with this model of early school start times.
Well said. So let's talk about, everyone I'm sure has experienced that feeling of like several days of not getting a good night's sleep, and you feel you're more susceptible to whatever virus or whatever's going around. Talk about that link between lack of sleep and your immune system. How does that break down?
It's such a powerful link, and it's remarkable. And I think, we as sleep scientists are simply putting the data behind everything your mother and Shakespeare ever told you about sleep, essentially. And here is, when you get to, you say, you're getting sick a lot, are you sleeping enough? And absolutely right. Firstly, what we know is that if you are sleeping, let's say, 5 to 6 hours a night, you're 3 to 4 times more likely to catch a cold relative to if you are sleeping 8 hours or more. And it was a very carefully controlled study. It was done here at UCSF by Eric Prath, a wonderful scientist. And he was shooting cold virus up people's noses. And he then quarantined them in a hotel for a week, watched if they became infected, and then looked at how much sleep they were getting the week before. Great study, clear data. Second, I will tell you that if you are getting just 5 or 6 hours of sleep in the week before you get your flu shot, you will only produce 50% of the normal antibody response, rendering that flu shot largely ineffective. Think of how much we could help the healthcare industry by tracking people's sleep. This is where technology comes in. And making sure they are ready for their flu shot by way of that foundational base of sleep. I could also tell you, and this is in part the reason why the link between a lack of sleep and cancer is so strong, one night of just 4 hours of sleep will drop critical anti-cancer fighting immune cells called natural killer cells by 70%, 70. Now, it turns out that everyone here listening to my voice today, your body produced cancer cells. What stops those cancer cells from becoming the disease that we call cancer is in part these natural killer cells, these vital immune assassins. And so what you want is a virile set of those natural killer cells at all times, and you will not have that if you're not getting sufficient sleep. And the link between a lack of sleep and cancer, we now know, includes cancer of the bowel, cancer of the prostate, and cancer of the breast. And the data has become so strong that recently the World Health Organization decided to classify any form of nighttime shift work as a probable carcinogen. In other words, jobs that may induce cancer because of a disruption of your sleep-wake rhythms. That's how critical the link between sleep and the immune system is.
Wow, it's powerful stuff. It really is. I want to move on to the benefits of sleep. You've described sleep as the most powerful elixir of wellness. And then after we discuss some of the benefits and beauty sleep, I want to talk about some of the tips you have for getting a good night's sleep. So you're recommending making sleep a priority in your life. It's almost like a mind shift that you're recommending through the book. And 7 to 9 hours, ideally 8 hours of sleep. Talk about the scientific evidence for how sleep helps your productivity, your longevity, and there's evidence for beauty sleep. There is such a thing.
There is, yeah. So I like to think of sleep almost as though it's the Swiss Army knife of health. You know, no matter what it faces, it's more than likely it has a tool in its box that will help. I mean, sleep is Mother Nature's best effort yet at contra-death. So firstly, we know that deep sleep is perhaps the most wonderful form of blood pressure medication that you could ever imagine. Your heart rate drops, stress chemicals drop, your blood pressure drops. Wonderful things happen there within the cardiovascular system. We know that the immune system gets this reboot, this replenishment, when you get sufficient amounts of sleep. We also know that those critical appetite hormone components are actually essentially recharged and restored back to the optimal sort of balance rather than the non-optimal that we spoke about too. Upstairs in the brain, we've spoken about how critical sleep is for learning and memory. It's also good for other things too. Firstly, sleep is wonderful for creativity. And this is the third way that sleep is important for information processing. So deep sleep is the essential factor that imprints and saves the memories. But it's during dream sleep or rapid eye movement sleep when the brain actually takes everything that it's recently learned and then starts to collide it with all of your back catalog of information stored within the brain. And it starts to seek out novel connections and associations. It's almost like group therapy for memories. And what happens is that you wake up the next day with a revised mind-wide web one that has started to divine remarkable solutions to previously faced problems. And there is no shortage of anecdotes where people have woken up sort of with that critical insight to a difficult problem that they could not solve. And there's probably a reason that no one has ever told you to stay awake on a problem. Instead, they tell you to sleep on a problem. And in every language that I've inquired about to date, from French to Swahili, that phrase, sleeping on a problem, seems to exist. What that means is that the creative benefits of dream sleep transcend cultural boundaries. It's common across the globe. I should also note, by the way, I believe, and someone can correct me if I'm wrong, I think the French translation is that it's much closer to you sleep with a problem. We, the Brits, you sleep on a problem. The French, you sleep with a problem. I think it says so much about the romantic difference between the British and the French. I'll probably lose my British passport for saying that. So what we've really discovered is that there is no tissue or organ within the body, and there is no process of the mind that is not wonderfully enhanced by sleep when you get it, or detrimentally impaired when you don't get enough.
Right, that's powerful stuff. Talk about, can you break it down? There was a really good part in your book. You use a lot of metaphors in the book to help a layperson understand. And you break it down into REM sleep and non-REM sleep. And you talk about the sculpture. Can you give that analogy so that people understand what happens in an eight-hour time slot of sleep?
So sleep is not just this one constant thing, it turns out. You actually have at least two principal types of sleep. One of them we call non-rapid eye movement sleep. The other we call rapid eye movement sleep. So when you fall asleep, or I should actually go back and say that those two types of sleep will actually play out in this incredible battle for brain domination throughout the night. And that cerebral war between non-REM and REM will actually be won and lost every 90 minutes and replayed every 90 minutes in humans. And that creates this cycling architecture of sleep, this 90-minute cycle. So you fall asleep and you go into the light stages of non-REM, then you'll go down into the deeper stages, what we call deep sleep, and you'll stay there for 30 or 40 minutes, and then you'll start to rise back up, and then after about 70 or 80 minutes, you'll pop up and you'll have a short REM sleep period where you dream. And then you go back down again, down into non-REM, up into REM. What's fascinating and what sleep science has yet to discover or solve or get any answers for is a bizarre truth, which is this. The amount of non-REM sleep and REM sleep within that 90-minute cycle are not stable across the night. What I mean is that in the first half of the night, the majority of those 90-minute cycles are comprised of lots of deep non-REM sleep and very little REM sleep. As you push through to the second half of the night, now that seesaw balance actually shifts, and the majority of those 90-minute cycles are comprised much more of rapid eye movement sleep and very little non-REM sleep. So we're starting to understand that each of these different stages carries out and transacts unique and different benefits for the brain and the body. But what we don't understand is why you have this very non-linear process. You get most of your deep sleep early in the night, and then you get most of your REM sleep late in the night. Why is that? We've got no idea.
So what are the implications of that for someone? You know, I talked with some audience members earlier, some insomniacs. What about people who fall asleep okay, and then they wake up maybe 4 in the morning, and that's it for them? They can't. What is the implication of these patterns on people like that?
I think one of the dangers with this non-linear, sort of this imbalance with REM and non-REM sleep is that people will say, well, you know, I go to bed early. Well, you think of your classic Olympic trainer, you know, Olympic coach who sort of has their athlete training until the evening, and then they wake them up and they're back on the athletic ground at 6 a.m. in the morning. And let's say that they lopped off 2 hours of their sleep, the last 2 hours. So you could ask the question, so how much total sleep have they lost? Well, it's 2 hours out of 8, so they've only lost 25% of their sleep. Well, yes, but not really. because they may have lost 25% of their total sleep time, but they may have actually removed 70 or 80% of their REM sleep, because it's in that last couple of hours where you're getting all of that REM-rich phase of sleep. So you have to be very careful. If you top and tail sleep, as it were, lose some hours in the first half of the night or in the last half of the night, you've got to be careful, because that imbalance will come round and hurt you. And there is no one single stage of sleep that's important. This is another myth. People will often ask me, you know, how do I get more deep sleep, or how do I get more dream sleep? There is no need for any more of either of those two, because both are important. And secondly, as I said, it took Mother Nature a very long time to understand exactly what quotient of these different types of sleep that you're getting at different times of night. Don't mess around with it. She's got a pretty good prescription, is my guess. Her blueprint is very accurate. Let it play out and don't try to sort of wise out sleep. Again, it probably come with deleterious consequences if you try.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Okay, so let's talk about the nemesis of sleep, caffeine. We've all taken that espresso after dinner one night and had a terrible night. Or even, I understand, even if you can fall asleep, that sleep you're getting isn't quality sleep. So talk about caffeine, and you've described it as the most widely used and abused psychoactive stimulant in the world. Talk about that.
It is. So it is a class of drugs that we call the psychoactive stimulants. It is the only active stimulant that we readily give and freely give to our children, I should note. The reason that it's probably one of the largest and mostly unsupervised drug studies that's conducted on the planet every single day is because caffeine is the second most traded commodity on the surface of the planet after oil. Now, you don't need me to give you all of the stats about epidemiological studies and how little sleep we're getting. That statistic alone, I think, is perhaps the most powerful demonstration of how we as a society are self-medicating our state of sleep deprivation. How does caffeine work? Well, it's really interesting that during the day, from the moment we all woke up this morning, a chemical has been building up in our brain called adenosine. And the more of that chemical that builds up, the sleepier that you feel. So you start to build up this chemical sleep pressure. Now, it's not a hydraulic pressure in your brain, don't worry. It's just a chemical pressure. And after about 16 hours of being awake, you should be sleepy enough that you fall asleep soundly and then stay asleep. Caffeine actually will race into the brain, and it will latch onto the welcome sites in the brain of adenosine. So it essentially masks the sleepiness signal in your brain.
I think you call it like a mute button.
It's like a mute button that you can hit on sleepiness. Now, that sleepiness chemical, adenosine, is still there in the brain, and it's still building up all the while the caffeine is inside of your skull. But you just don't realize that you're as sleepy because you're not getting the signal anymore. Now, the problem is that when the caffeine wears off after a couple of hours, you have a caffeine crash because all of that sleepiness races back in and impacts your brain. Now, some people will tell me, well, I'm one of those people for whom caffeine doesn't keep me awake at night. I can fall asleep and I stay asleep just fine. The problem with that is even if you can fall asleep, the depth of this deep sleep that you get when caffeine is present in your brain is not as deep compared to when you are caffeine free. So therefore, people wake up the next morning, they feel unrefreshed, they don't remember waking up or struggling with falling asleep, so they never put two and two together. And then they have to reach for two cups of coffee in the morning rather than one.
Right.
And so creates exactly a cycle of dependency.
Right. So what is your recommendation for caffeine intake?
Recommendation would be cease caffeine intake after one or two in the afternoon.
Right. And that's Coffee, energy drinks, chocolate too? Do you include chocolate?
Keep an eye out on every ingredient packet. You'd be surprised at the things that actually have caffeine in them. Also, be a little bit wary of decaf. Decaf does not mean no caf. And decaffeinated coffee can have caffeine levels ranging from 5 up to 30% of a full cup of coffee. So if it's on the high end and you have 3 or 4 cups of decaf after dinner, then you're well within the territory of one normal cup of coffee.
Okay, so we're moving on to solutions to insomnia. Sleeping pills, $30 billion a year industry in the United States. You write in your book, it's a blunt instrument. It simply sedates your brain. And it's no longer recommended as the first line treatment for insomnia by the American Medical Association. Can you explain why?
I can, and I want to frame this by putting up front that I am not anti-medication. I think when medications are good, I am in all favor of them. It's simply that no drug that we have right now can accurately mimic or assist this thing called naturalistic sleep. The current sleeping pills that most people take are a class of drugs that we tend to call the sedative hypnotics. And sedation is not sleep. Now, when you take these medications, I'm not going to argue that you're awake. You're clearly not. But to suggest that you're in naturalistic sleep is an equal falsehood. The other issue with sleeping pills is that they've been associated with a significantly higher risk of death and cancer. And that evidence, I don't think, has been accurately communicated to the public. And that was one of the chapters in the book. It was an express chapter in the book to try and arm people with the science. Now, I also want to be clear that we don't yet know whether that link between sleeping pills and death and cancer is simply a correlation versus causal. It could, for example, be as a counter-argument that those people who are using sleeping pills are those people who've struggled with a lack of sleep for all of their lives, and it's the lack of sleep that's catching up with them and related to death and cancer, and it looks like the sleeping pills are associated with it. But it's equally possible that they do increase your risk of death and cancer. So I think what I wanted to do by writing that chapter is not try to target the drug companies. I know the scientists, many of them in those companies, and they are wonderful people who are desperately trying to do good things for our health, and I applaud them. It's just that people have not been made aware of that evidence, and I want you to have that evidence because almost 10 million people in the last month in the US alone have swallowed some kind of sleep aid. That's how desperate the need is for sleep. And people are doing it without that evidence. So just be informed, and that's what I hope that chapter in the book actually does. It gives people the knowledge, and they can make an informed choice, and they can speak with their doctor.
Right. What about people that swear by Benadryl or magnesium pills?
Well, so Benadryl doesn't work in the same way that those classic sleep medications do. Benadryl was actually looked at in some of those studies and also does have some of those same associations. So you have to be a little bit careful there too. Magnesium data is somewhat unclear. Its benefit, if there is one, may be more on muscle relaxation than necessarily within the brain itself.
Got it. So you have a chapter on cognitive behavioral therapy. What is that and how does it work?
That is now the recommendation as the alternative to sleeping pills for insomnia. So based on a review of 64 carefully controlled placebo studies, a panel of scientific experts several years ago looking at sleeping pills versus placebo suggested that they could not see a reliable, significant benefit of sleeping pills over placebo for sleep enhancement, and that the clinical significance, and this was their words, not mine, was of questionable importance. And then in 2016, the American College of Physicians made a landmark recommendation. They suggested that this alternative, which is called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI, should be the first-line recommendation for insomnia, not sleeping pills, because of the risks associated with sleeping pills. What is CBTI? You work with a therapist who identifies a number of different issues regarding your poor sleep. It's somewhat tailored to you as the individual. So there's not a sort of, you know, the 5 or 6 key CBTI techniques. There's a whole range of them. And it's like a Savile Row suit. They tailor it to you. And what's great is that this psychological intervention requires no swallowing of medication, no side effects. It's just as effective as sleeping pills in the short term, but better when you stop working with your therapist, you maintain those benefits, unlike sleeping pills, where when you stop them, not only do you tend to go back to the bad sleep that you are having, you tend to regress and actually have what's called rebound insomnia, which is where your sleep is even worse. So people need not look to pharmacology at this stage.
Right. So one of the CBT points in your book was mentally decelerating before bed. What does that mean? We're here in Silicon Valley and there's a lot of fast processing and these brainiac brains out there. Talk about how one can mentally decelerate. What do you do to mentally decelerate before bed?
It's very clear that it is one of the principal causes of insomnia. There are many causes. But psychological is perhaps fast becoming one of the, I think, the most prominent. And it's a sign of the day and age, I think, that we are constantly in modernity throughout the waking day on this stream of reception. And it's only when our head hits the pillow that we go into reflection. And that's the last thing that you should be doing when you're trying to fall asleep. You know, it's this Rolodex mind, and at that point, you're dead in the water with anxieties for the next couple of hours. And it, I think, is a major problem. It's not just concerns of the current day. It's about, we know from surveys, it's about finances, it's about professional life, it's about emotional relationships. All of these things tend to keep us awake, as well as the small things. What didn't I do today? What did I forget? What must I do tomorrow? One of the things that people can do, firstly, is just write it all down before you get into bed. Catharsis is a wonderful tool in this regard. The other thing, though, is that if you're struggling with sleep and those spinning wheels of the mind, meditation. Now, I am quite a hard-nosed scientist, you know, and I look to biology and physiology, but I looked at the data several years ago, some great studies, some of them coming out of Stanford. It's very, very powerful for insomnia, meditation. And when I was traveling back home to the UK, I'm not immune to jet lag just because I know something about sleep doesn't help me necessarily. And to at least sort of change my biology in that regard. But I started to meditate. And it was very effective. And that was actually 5 months ago. And I'm still meditating today.
Good for you. So tell us, we're here in Silicon Valley. What about apps, particularly for meditation? Do you have an app or several apps that you recommend?
There are lots of apps out there. I actually use an app called Headspace. Another great app that is out there is called Calm. Both of those, I think, are wonderful tools. They both have dedicated sections specifically for sleep-guided relaxation. So those are wonderful tools, and I'm sure there are lots of other opportunities out there. What I would say is, though, it can be a little bit problematic because, you know, to use those apps, you have to open your phone, you open your phone, you open your email, 2 a.m., bad deal. Mm-hmm. So start to learn how to meditate during the day. And then just sort of try to do a DIY, you know, do-it-yourself type scenario at night. And just walk yourself through that guided meditation. And that can be hugely helpful too. And you don't need that technology in the bedroom, therefore.
Great. So you've said that technology, it has invaded our bedroom, but it could be our salvation. Talk about the role of tech and, you know, wearables, for example, other apps that you feel can help people get to sleep.
Well, I certainly agree with most of my sleep research colleagues that the invasion of technology into the bedroom has done us a great disservice in that regard. We know that smartphones create anxiety, lift you out of the deep sleep. People will wake up throughout the night. It also creates something that we call sleep procrastination. There's such a thing. You're there, you're in bed, you could easily fall asleep, but you've got your device, so you start texting, last email, Facebook, and now it's half an hour later, no good. Blue light from those emitting devices is desperately damaging. It blocks the rise of a hormone called melatonin, and you need melatonin to be able to time your sleep effectively. And iPad use for 1 hour before bed will actually shift your it will delay your melatonin levels by 2 to 3 hours. So here in California, 1 hour of iPad use, and we're essentially close to Hawaii in terms of our melatonin rhythms. That's how damaging it can be. But unlike perhaps many of my sleep colleagues, I actually don't think we should throw the baby out with the bathwater in terms of technology. I think in the future, it will be our salvation. And firstly, by the way, that genie of technology is out the bottle and it is not going back in. You know, sort of having that prudish mentality of saying, you know, no technology in the bedroom, it's not going to happen. So let's embrace it and think about smart ways. One of the ways is the basic understanding of how you've slept. So if I were to ask you all, how did you sleep last night? You could probably tell me. If I were to ask you, how did you sleep Wednesday, 2 weeks ago? No idea. And if you don't know, how can you see patterns and identify problems? And in medicine, often we say what gets measured gets managed. And I think as people start to develop an awareness of their sleep and see patterns, they will start to actually help prioritize their sleep a little more. Then, as technology companies, we can actually start to use that and pick out those problematic patterns and relate them to waking daytime behaviors. And then we can show people what's causing their poor sleep. And we can give them behavioral nudges. We can use principles of behavioral economics, and we can change their behavior that will actually co-opt better sleep at night and therefore improve your waking activities during the day and create this golden loop. So I have a huge amount of faith in technology. It may be misplaced, but I definitely think, unlike many others, it's going to be part of the sleep solution, unlike currently, I think, where it's part of the sleep problem.
Right. Now, we've got a number of questions. I think we must have about 30 or 40 questions in the audience. This is great. And a recurring question is napping. Talk about napping and power napping. Is there such a thing?
There is such a thing. And naps are a double-edged sword. So we have done lots of research studies with naps, and naps are beneficial. You can get learning and memory benefits from naps. You can get emotional regulation benefits from naps. You can get bodily benefits from naps. However, it comes back to our story of sleepiness. When we sleep at night, the brain actually washes away all of that sleepiness chemical adenosine. And after about 8 hours of sleep, you've washed away 16 hours of sleepiness so that you wake up feeling refreshed. The problem with naps is that if you take them later in the day, it's like releasing the pressure valve on that sleepiness. So you release some of that sort of good, healthy, sleepy pressure so that then when it comes time to fall asleep at night, you start to struggle and it's harder to fall asleep and stay asleep. So if you do not struggle with sleep at night and you can nap regularly, the advice is, naps during the day are okay, but if you can't nap regularly and or you have problems with sleep at night, the advice is don't nap.
And is there a time constraint? I've heard you shouldn't nap after, say, 3 p.m. Do you have a rule of thumb about that?
If you're going to nap, usually napping earlier in the day is better. But again, stick to those principles. If you struggle with sleep, stay away from naps.
Got it. So another question for the audience, what is the role of sleep and depression? We had another question, someone who's a manic depressive. Talk about that in the context of sleep.
We've done a lot of work in this area of sleep and mental health. Sleep is a form of mental first aid. It's emotional first aid. And we understand particularly that it's dream sleep that provides a nocturnal soothing balm that takes the sharp edges off painful emotional experiences, and it rebalances the emotional circuitry in the brain. And in fact, we have not been able to discover a single psychiatric condition in which sleep is normal. So I think sleep has a profound story to tell in our understanding, our treatment, and ultimately our prevention of grave mental illness. Now, one of the places that we see a very strong relationship is in depression, both in major depression, which is where people come into phases of sort of feeling normal and feeling very down and depressed and then feeling normal again, and also in bipolar disorder, what people used to call manic depression, where you'd have these phases of sort of being stable, and then you'd have these wild manic phases where everything looks great and very enthusiastic, to then very deep depressions as a result. we know the evidence there is actually causal, because often what happens before a phase of mania is that sleep becomes disrupted. People start to sleep less. It seems to be a warning beacon within the brain that there is a mania event that is about to happen. We also know that you can trigger a manic phase by way of depriving people of sleep. There was a study done in Italy, which I think ethically you could argue is conspicuous. And they took people who were suffering from bipolar, but who were in a stable state, and they deprived them of sleep. And they triggered an onset of mania in those patients. So a lack of sleep is a causal trigger. It's not simply associational. And I think psychiatry has often thought, yes, sleep loss or sleep disruption in psychiatric disorders go hand in hand, but it's the psychiatric condition that is causing the sleep problems. Now, I think we have to realize that it's a very different story. It is a two-way street. It's bidirectional. And if anything, perhaps the traffic is flowing more in the direction of a lack of sleep, instigating psychiatric problems, but it's definitely two-way.
Great. Good information. So here's a timely question. Is marijuana helpful to get to sleep?
Marijuana and alcohol, probably the two most misunderstood drugs when it comes to sleep, maybe after caffeine. Marijuana, people use to try and help them relax and get to sleep. Some people will fall asleep quicker. The problem is that marijuana will actually block your dream sleep. So it's not advised. Alcohol, big problem. Again, people will think, I have a nightcap, I fall asleep faster. Wrong, because alcohol is also a sedative. So what you're doing is just knocking out the cortex of your brain. You're sort of losing consciousness. That's the first problem with alcohol. The second is that alcohol will fragment your sleep. So you wake up many times throughout the night, so short that you tend not to remember them. So you don't commit them to sort of experience. So you wake up the next morning thinking, there wasn't anything wrong with my sleep, but I feel unrefreshed and I don't know why. The third part about alcohol is that, like marijuana, but through a different mechanism, it also blocks your dream sleep. So I'm so deeply unpopular with everyone for lots of personal reasons. But one of them is that I always say, you know, no alcohol, no marijuana, no caffeine. You know, the politically incorrect advice that I would never say on in front of an audience or a podcast or my students in my large sleep class at Berkeley is that if you're going to drink alcohol, go to the pub in the morning, because that way the alcohol is washed out of your system by the evening and everything will be fine. But I would never say that. That's utterly irresponsible.
That's great. Do you have any advice on dealing with jet lag?
Jet lag is very difficult. If you're going on a long flight, transatlantic, let's say California to London, don't do what most people do, which is they sleep in the last couple of hours of the flight. If you're going to sleep, sleep early in the flight, wake up, and then start to build up all of that sleep pressure that you need, and then stay awake throughout the day when you land. And that way you will be tired enough to fall asleep in the new time zone. That's day number one. For the rest of the time, it takes about... Well, your body clock will acclimate 1 hour for every day you're in a new time zone. So to get back to London, 8 hour time difference, it's going to take me 8 days, but I can help myself. I can try to eat at the times when everyone else is eating, because food is a trigger to actually reprogram your body clock. The other is daylight. Get out in the morning in the new time zone. If you need some protection, wear it, but do not wear shades. Get lots of bright light in the morning, then do the opposite in the afternoon. Wear shades in the afternoon and block that light to allow melatonin to rise. We need darkness for melatonin to creep up, and that will help time your sleep. So regular feeding, physical activity during the morning, lots of daylight in the morning, then lots of darkness in the afternoon and evening.
Good advice. A question from presumably a young parent. Does your sleep ever recover from early parenthood?
In that regard, I don't have knowledge, but I've been told it does. But I've often thought that this is Mother Nature's wonderful way to actually instigate population boom, because you're so sleep deprived when you're a new parent. And we know sleep is related to memory. So you basically suffer amnesia. And so... after about sort of 18 months after the first child, you know, maybe you look to your wife and you say, well, was it that bad? I don't think I remember it being that bad. Was it? Do you remember? No, I don't. Should we have a second? Yes, let's have a second. You know, because Mother Nature has wiped out the memory of how underslept and how terrible it was by way of the lack of sleep. Beautiful lack of birth control.
Right, so a bit of nostalgia there.
Yeah.
Question from the audience. I can finally get to sleep with regular use of melatonin. However, my sleep is troublesome and I often have creepy dreams. Why?
So melatonin turns out not to be a very efficacious sleep aid unless you are traveling between time zones or you are a more senior individual, sort of in people who are 60, 70, 80 years old. That's when melatonin can be helpful to help generate sleep. In everyone else, it doesn't seem to provide any sleep benefit. And the reason is this. Melatonin works to time your sleep. So think of melatonin like the starting official in the 100-meter race at the Olympics. It brings everyone to the beginning line of the race and fires the gun to begin the great sleep race. But the official doesn't participate in the race itself. That's a whole different set of chemical ingredients and brain mechanisms. So in that way, that's the reason that melatonin actually doesn't help generate or produce better sleep. It helps the timing of when sleep occurs, but nothing more. Now, I would say this, however, that if you are taking melatonin and you feel that it helps you, keep taking it. Why? Because the placebo effect is one of the most reliable effects in all of pharmacology. And by the way, that tells us something profound. There is such a thing as mind over matter. Your brain can change the health of your body. And science has only started to wake up to this reality. There's a wonderful science of the placebo effect now, and rightly so.
Good. Question from the audience. What do I do with the sleep data from my smart watch?
Well, currently, the products on the market right now are not so bad at telling total sleep time, but when you start to look at how they stack up against the high degree of granular specificity that I could record at my sleep center with electrodes placed all over your head, they're just not accurate yet. So are we going to get there in maybe 2 to 3 years? I think probably yes. I think there will be commercially available devices out there that will have that type of accuracy or close to it. So right now, I think we're just missing the mark on that regard.
Right. So wait a couple of years.
Yep.
Okay. Question from the audience. What do you think is one of the biggest misconceptions when it comes to sleep?
I would say hands down that notion that I'm one of those people who can survive on 6 hours of sleep. What we know is that from 10,000 plus research studies, the number of people who can survive on 6 hours of sleep or less and show no measurable impairment, rounded to a whole number and expressed as a percent of the population, is zero.
Interesting. But there are rare exceptions, like Margaret Thatcher apparently operated on, 4 hours of sleep? There are other leaders like that claim...
So the problem with sleep deprivation is this, that your subjective sense of how well you're doing with insufficient sleep is a miserable predictor of objectively how well you're doing with insufficient sleep. And I'm not pointing my finger at any current heads of state right now, but I will make two additional points. That the problem, therefore, is it's a little bit like a drunk driver at a bar who's had 7 shots. They pick up their car keys and they say, "I'm fine to drive home." And your response is, "No, I know that you think you're fine to drive, but objectively, trust me, you're not." The same is true for sleep. And that's one of the problems. That's why people say, you know, I definitely can survive on, you know, just 6 hours. There is a very rare genetic anomaly that allows people to survive on 5 hours of sleep, and we can't see any impairments yet. But it is a fraction of 1% of the population. To put it in context, you are far more likely to be struck by lightning in your lifetime than be one of those genetic anomalies, the odds being about 12,500 to 1. I think that that's one of the most striking, I think, myths about sleep. I would come back to your point about Margaret Thatcher, two of the most vocal heads of state regarding their lack of sleep, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. Now, it was a great PR campaign, I think. You know, they want to seem extraordinary, extra human. They want to seem as though they're not like the rest of us, that they are bold leaders who are different. I don't think it's perhaps coincidental, knowing what we now know between the link of a lack of sleep and Alzheimer's disease, that both Reagan and Thatcher tragically went on to develop Alzheimer's.
That's a good point. Several questions about the timing of sleep. There are some night owls among us. Does it matter when you have those 7-8 hours?
So there is a genetic propensity for you to be a morning person or an evening person. It's not just your will. It's not. Society actually has a terrible, I think, a dim view of the night owls. Those people who like to go to bed late and wake up late. You know, we think of them as lazy people because they're sleeping in the morning. Whereas the early bird sort of catches the worm, all of these phrases, the larks are the people who get the celebration, as it were. And that's wrong, because it's nobody's fault. It's genetics. It's called your chronotype. And we know the genes that dictate whether you're a morning type or an evening type. So I think people need to walk in lockstep with their natural genetic edict for when they should sleep. Sleeping in a complete phase reversal is not good. So this is night shift workers. This is why even night shift workers who then get 8 hours of sleep during the day, the sleep that they get is not of the same quality as 8 hours at night, because we were not designed as a species to be sleeping during the day. So it's very poor quality sleep.
Got it. So unfortunately, we have time for just one last question. Can you tell us, you are definitely the biggest sleep expert in the room tonight. You have spent your whole life seriously studying sleep. Tell us about your personal bedtime routine.
It sounds hokey and it does sound trite, and I'm sorry if it sounds this way, but I give myself a non-negotiable 8-hour sleep opportunity every night. I practice what I preach. And if you knew the evidence, as I do, and as I hope people who read the book will do, you would just choose to do nothing other than that. So I shut off laptops and computers at least an hour and a half before bed. I have a sort of a wind-down routine. Probably the best piece of advice I could give everyone is regularity. Go to bed at the same time, wake up at the same time, no matter whether it's the weekday or the weekend. I am ruthless about that, and everyone should be too. Otherwise, you get into this social jet lag at the weekend, and it's terrible for your biological clock. I stop drinking caffeine around 11 o'clock in the morning. I dim half the lights down in the last hour before bed. We don't need them all on. We are a dark-deprived society, unfortunately. That helps my melatonin. Keeping the bedroom cool is what I also do. Your body temperature needs to drop by about 1 degree Celsius or about 2 or 3 degrees Fahrenheit to initiate sleep. That's the reason it's always easier to fall asleep in a room that's too cold than too hot. Too cold is taking you in the right temperature direction you need for good sleep. So I keep my bedroom cool as well.
What temperature?
I usually keep it somewhere around about the 67 to 68 mark. Sounds cold. If you get cold feet, that's okay. Put socks on, but keep the bedroom cool.
Great. All good advice. So I hope you've all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. We would like to thank Professor Matt Walker, author of Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you listening on the radio. And now this meeting is adjourned.